Welcome to Eye to Eye, the podcast of the Royal College of Ophthalmologists. My name is Sunil Mamtora, and I will be your host.
Today I'm speaking with Samantha Hunt, an ophthalmology registrar who works at the Bristol Eye Hospital. We're going to be speaking about her work, which investigated regional differences in the funding of oculoplastic procedures. Samantha, thanks a lot for joining me today to talk about your work. You know, before we talk about your study, I was wondering whether you might be able to give the listeners an overview, perhaps, on the changes to funding in recent years for procedures in ophthalmology in general.
Hi, Sunil. Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here to talk about this subject that I'm quite passionate about. As we all know, the NHS is a finite resource, so there's some allocation of resources that needs to happen. Now, in 2013, the clinical commissioning groups took over from the primary care trusts with respect to funding their own local resources, and that's across services. Ophthalmology has not been excluded from the need to allocate resources in an efficient manner, and that has affected subspecialties across ophthalmology. So one example would be in medical retina, where patients with wet macular degeneration, for example, have to meet certain visual acuity criteria before they would be eligible for treatment with anti-VEGF injections. Another area that's been affected is with treatment for chalazia via incision and curettage, which is now being restricted sort of across the board. And interestingly enough, there are still some regions across the country where access to second eye cataract surgery is now being restricted.
You know, so we often hear the term postcode lottery, and from what you say, there's been a lot of changes nationally, but is there a big variation between CCGs across the country?
So the term postcode lottery was something that's been coined by the media that essentially describes how one person might have access to a service or a treatment that they have a medical need for in one location in the country, but due to local variation in funding policies, their neighbour a few streets down or somebody across the country won't necessarily have access to that treatment or that service despite having the same medical or clinical need. And this is something that has arisen since the CCGs took over from the primary care trusts in 2013. The reasoning behind that was that the CCGs were intended to be able to determine their own local needs and adjust the funding of different services according to their needs. So, for example, if you have a very elderly population, you might choose to invest heavily in falls prevention services or total hip replacements. Whereas if you've got a younger but perhaps obese population, you may feel that your money is better spent in weight management programs or continuous glucose monitoring devices, for example. And that has inevitably meant that in order to fund the areas of the greatest clinical need, that CCGs, with their finite funding pot, are now restricting access to procedures that they consider to be of a low clinical value, which very commonly is procedures that may be perceived as being only cosmetic in nature.
With these restrictions on funding, which vary from region to region, it sounds like it would lead to possibly some significant healthcare inequality. You know, do you think this is the case? And what should we be doing about this?
Absolutely. If you've got two individuals in the country with the same clinical need, they should have access to the same quality of care at the same speed in order to address that issue. And what you'll now find by having local policies in place is that people with the same medical need either don't have access to the same level of care because of policies that are in place, or actually just needing to jump through the hoops in order to obtain the funding, which may require additional appointments or additional tests that might otherwise not be clinically indicated, is delaying care. So that has that has consequences for the patient all the time. They have this unmet need.
From personal experience, I've had a few quite difficult conversations with, you know, either relatives of patients or patients, when I have to tell them that unfortunately we can't offer them a procedure due to the policies of the local CCG. Could you perhaps share any advice or experience that you've had with patients when you've had to tell them that you can't offer them a procedure because of local funding?
Yes, so those are obviously very difficult conversations to have. And patients do know that the NHS has only got a limited budget, and they do understand conceptually that therefore not everything can be available to everybody. But it's quite a different situation when it's them that's affected. Now, we need to just acknowledge the fact that not all patients that come to us with a perceived concern have a pathological problem that requires treatment on the NHS. And actually having policies in place that we can then lean back on and explain to the patient that this service is not available for them on the NHS for these reasons can be quite helpful. However, if you have a patient in front of you that you feel has a clinical indication for a certain treatment, and for whatever reason, according to local policy, they wouldn't be able to access it, it is our job as clinicians to be our patient's advocate. So I think you have to calmly explain the current situation and explain why procedures and services are restricted and why those policies are in place, and then explain that actually you feel that this patient does have a clinical need and you will apply for funding, explaining why they should be allowed to have funding for this procedure. And then you need to outline what happens next, so that if they are still declined funding, how they can proceed next.
How often do you personally complete an individual funding request for a patient? And, you know, out of interest, do you know what your success rate for those requests are?
I personally have only completed sort of two or three funding requests, but in my experience, they were all declined, despite my having documented how the patients met the criteria outlined in our local policies, which is obviously a significant area of concern, because if these policies have been put in place with forethought as to why those criteria exist, then we need to be confident as clinicians that those policies are in fact being applied fairly and in line with those policies. So what happened in those situations was I then escalated the situation up to my consultant, who resubmitted the application with further information. But unfortunately, I don't know the outcome of those. What I do know is in a small survey we did as a sort of extra bit of work alongside the main project, we did a survey of oculoplastic consultants across the country, and we found that about 60% of those consultants were spending 30 or more minutes per week completing these forms. And again, that's something that's really important to consider, because that does then have a knock-on impact if this is going to be an increasing problem as restrictions get worse during the future.
The paperwork burden, and, you know, 30 minutes to complete paperwork per week is, you know, it's a psychological burden that's possibly preventing ophthalmologists from acting as the best advocate they can be for the patients.
I agree, absolutely. And some consultants will perhaps manage this by delegating to their team members, but ideally you want it to be the consultant that has seen the patient that's completing the paperwork, because, as you say, that means they've got the best possible opportunity to be an advocate for their patient. Another thing to consider, of course, is those consultants that offer the same procedures privately have a really difficult situation, because there's a bit of a conflict of interest there when they apply for funding for their patients. Because if that funding is declined and the patient opts to do so, that consultant has the potential to benefit from that via their private work. So some consultants choose not to complete this paperwork and refer the patient back to the GP. But again, the GPs are not the experts, so it begs the question as to whether they would complete the paperwork in to the same quality that the consultant would do, and therefore whether we're giving the best possible opportunity for our patients with genuine clinical need to obtain the treatment that they deserve on the NHS.
That's really, really interesting. Now I really want to talk about the subject that the listeners want to hear about the most, which is your study. So Samantha, could you tell us all about your study?
2 years ago, in conjunction with Rebecca Ford, who's one of the oculoplastic consultants in Bristol Eye Hospital, we decided that we wanted to explore this issue in more detail, particularly with respect to oculoplastic procedures. And we wanted to determine whether there is any truth to this perception of a postcode lottery, and if there is, how has this arisen, and is it of a kind of clinically significant level? So what we did is we put in a freedom of information request to all 206 CCGs that existed at that time, and I should note that there are now 135, so this is something that is always changing. And we asked for information on relevant oculoplastic procedures as to how patients access those, what criteria are applied, if any, to determine who is eligible for treatment and who isn't, and who was involved in drafting those policies and creating those systems.
That's really interesting. That sounds like a huge amount of work. So, congratulations on being able to do this amazing study. What would be really interesting is to actually hear your results and whether or not you feel that the term postcode lottery is actually an appropriate term.
Yes, you're right. It was a massive amount of work. Some of the CCGs chose to respond directly to the queries I made, but the majority of them signposted me to their policies online. Now, I should note that I had tried to access them before I sent the Freedom of Information request, but actually it was surprisingly challenging. And that's an interesting point in itself, that clinicians are expected to follow these guidelines, but they're really hard to find. And in fact, a lot of them were quite difficult to interpret as well. So I think the key things that we found from this project was, first of all, only 7% of the CCGs were actually able to confirm for us that they had specific oculoplastic consultants' input when they created these policies. A further 11% said they had some form of eye professional involved in those policies, which is slightly... it's incredible, isn't it? You think that if you were going to draft a policy about a procedure, that you would ensure that you'd consulted the experts on that procedure who would understand the latest evidence about those procedures and how they impact on their patients, and can give clear information about how clinical practice works in real life. And I think that is reflected in the outcomes of those policies. So, the key question here that you asked about whether or not a postcode lottery is in fact a fair term, we think it is. We found significant variation in how patients access care across the country, with some procedures continuing to be routinely funded and not necessarily having specific policies in place, and others being very, very restricted, with needing individual funding requests without any clear guidelines as to who might be approved for treatment. And then you've got the middle ground, where there are criterion that exist to guide that. And for some policies, that's quite clear. And for others, the access route is not clear. So there are criterion there, but you don't know whether or not you can proceed to surgery or treatment if your patient meets those criteria, or whether you actually have to still put in an individual funding approval request and get that approved before you then proceed on to surgery. What we did find is that blepharoplasty, for example, was the most consistently restricted via criterion-based access routes. Which I think kind of makes sense, because amongst oculoplastic procedures, it probably has the biggest reputation for being a cosmetic procedure, although of course there are patients that benefit functionally too. On the other hand, we found that ectropion was the most variably funded, with roughly a third of policies routinely funding care, a third being criterion-based access, and a third specifically requiring funding approval before you proceed to surgery.
I mean, that's really, really interesting. You know, I suppose one thing we've got to remember is that even though your study focused on oculoplastic procedures, it's clear that this is a problem, not just in ophthalmology, but throughout medicine. I find it really alarming that you mentioned that some CCGs advise that their policies weren't always made with the advice of ophthalmologists, because it may be possible that governing bodies are generating policies which may limit sight-threatening procedures, such as cross-linking, for example, without possibly even understanding the clinical and life-changing consequences that these procedures may have. The main question I would have for you is, do you think we should have more nationalised guidelines for the funding of procedures? You know, would you have any suggestions for anything that you think you'd like us to see in an ideal world?
Certainly. I don't think there has been any evidence found that there is in fact a significant variation in local need, particularly with oculoplastic procedures, but that may well be the case for many other conditions too. What I found in my study is that actually a significant number of CCGs had chosen to adopt shared policies, usually with their regional counterparts, which may well be for logistical reasons, so that clinicians in sort of large hospitals who receive patients from multiple CCGs in the area don't have to try and recall multiple different policies and different criteria. But I think actually that supports the notion that there probably isn't that much difference in local need from one region to the next. And actually involving the experts, you know, the medical body in the relevant field, so as per my study, the oculoplastic consultants, is much more likely to end up with realistically applicable policies that are fair and pragmatic and take into consideration things like resource usage. So we've talked about restrictions being put in place to save resources, but I'm not sure whether the work has been done to prove that that actually works, particularly if the CCGs are requiring additional tests that might mean additional appointments and the such like, because there is a burden to the trust and to the patient associated with that too. And I think if you ask the people who are doing the work on a day-to-day basis, they will know what impact those additional tests are going to have, and whether or not there is a different way of evidencing a patient's need.
You know, Samantha, that's been really fascinating. And thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
As always, we'd love to hear from you. If you want to get involved, talk about your work, or have any feedback, send us a message at communications@rcops.ac.uk.